but at the end of the night, I always came home. She's known about New Paltz for a while now, but I kind of sprang this job on her. I didn't give her much time to mentally prepare. "I'm sorry," I say before she has a chance to respond. "I'll try to call more." "You really like it there? In Heron Mills?" "Yeah, it's great. I'm going to save a lot for the fall. Me being here, this is a good thing, Mom." She sighs. "I'm sure it is, doll. I just miss you." I listen to a story about one of her coworkers at the lab, then promise to text her pictures from Clovelly Cottage and the beach. When we hang up, I lean my head back against the recliner and let the fading light wash over my skin. The back of the house faces west, and the sun is the same brilliant orange orb behind the tree line it was at this time yesterday. It's beautiful. I tell myself to relax, focus on the girl I want to be. Just breathe.
Chapter 4. Now, August. Pathways Juvenile Center, East New York, Brooklyn. Girl, you are damn lucky. Hi? I cannot believe they've got you at Pathways. When Ryan Denny's grow house got busted sophomore year, they held him at fucking Rikers. On the other end of the line, Anna lets Kaylee's words sink in. She adjusts the phone's sticky plastic receiver against her ear and glances at the guard stationed down the hall, watching. Over the past 2 weeks, she's rarely considered herself lucky. She's back in Brooklyn, but this place could be anywhere. She's never felt so far from home. Yeah, lucky me. Anna shifts her weight, left foot, then right, and her Pathways assigned sneakers squish against the concrete floor. That night, with Detective Holloway and A.D. Massey, feels like another lifetime. In the 14 days following her arrest, she's been charged, processed, admitted, screened for medical, dental, and mental health, assessed for trauma, and assigned a caseworker named Aubrey, a flighty woman only a few years older than Anna, who doesn't seem cut out for the juvenile justice system. Anna should be home, packing for SUNY New Paltz. The semester will start next week, without her. A trial date hasn't even been set. But you're also totally delusional. You know that, right? This isn't the first time Anna has considered the possibility that something may be off balance with her mental health and wellness, as the counselors here like to say. At night, in her cot, she closes her eyes and sends a mental searchlight around the inside of her head, scanning for a sign, a clue, a patch of rot. But her mind stays inscrutable. And she passed her intake screening. No one has said a peep about mental illness. At least not to her face. Either she has everyone fooled, including herself, or her memories of that night are real. Maybe, she concedes to Kaylee. But I know what I remember. What I did. Murder Anna? Kaylee squeaks. You seriously think you killed some girl out in the Hamptons? Anna holds the receiver away from her ear until silence settles on the other end. She shifts her weight back and forth, listening to the squish-squish of her sneakers. Not murder. Manslaughter, she says softly. And the difference is, in the past 2 weeks, Anna has become an expert. They're charging me with manslaughter in the second degree. It means I recklessly caused her death. And then concealed her body, a second felony. The two charges combined carry 8 to 20 years in prison. Anna turns 18 in December. If convicted, they probably will send her to Rikers Island. There's been talk of shuttering the notorious jail complex for years, but it won't be fast enough for Anna. Your memories are shit, Kaylee says, shattering Anna's thoughts, a rock into a sheet of glass. You told them I was with you that night. Are you trying to punish me for what happened on the beach? Is that what this is about? It takes a minute for Anna to register what Kaylee's asking. Her mind travels back a month and a half to the 4th of July, on the beach, on Montauk, the last time she and Kaylee were together. It was just a party, and I was never mad. I thought you were. This isn't about that, not even close. Isn't really about Kaylee at all. You want to sink your own ship? Fine. Kaylee can't see Anna flinch at her poor choice of words. But leave me the hell out of it. All this time, I thought you were too messed up that night to remember anything. But apparently, you were much more messed up than I realized. What do you... Listen to me, Anna. If you remember anything real, you have to know what happened, whatever happened. It wasn't our fault. Anna tries to swallow, but her mouth is all sand and grit. I said you were inside when she died, she manages. I told them you didn't have anything to do with hiding her body. No shit, I didn't. Because I wasn't in the Hamptons, Anna. And neither were you. I don't know how you got things so freaking scrambled. Mom and I had the cops here earlier this week, you know that? Wanted to have a little chat about my account of New Year's Eve. Anna sucks in a sharp breath. What did you tell them? The truth, obviously. Well, the parts that mattered. That I never left Brooklyn. We never left Brooklyn. But Anna wants it to be true. But she knows better now. No, you listen. The story you told police, the one they wanted me to confirm, girl, you are way off, so let me jog your memory. We were at Stars. Everyone wanted to go dancing, but you were passed out on the couch. Mike and I got you in a cab, and you were home before 10. Got it? One more piece clicks into place for Anna. Kaylee got her in a cab. But Kaylee's not telling the whole truth, because she got in that cab too. She was with Anna at Windermere. Anna remembers the three of them on the balcony together. Zoe's silvery laugh in Anna's ear, Kaylee pinching her cheek, holding back her hair, the freezing bite of the night wind rolling in off the ocean. Do you have a lawyer, Anna? Kaylee asks, voice taut with exasperation. Of course I do. And what does he say? She says I shouldn't have talked to the police without my mom present, without hiring her first. Kaylee's sigh is so loud, Anna swears she can feel it blow through the phone line. Well, I guess it's too late for that now. From down the hall, the guard jerks her chin at Anna, taps her fingers to her wrist. Wrap it up. I have to go. Tell them to stop sniffing around my place. Deep in your heart, Anna Ciccone, you know no good is going to come of this. I really have to go. What you need is to get your head on straight. Tell them you were wrong. You didn't do it. Make that lawyer of yours get the charges dropped. But Anna did do it. How else can she explain everything she remembers about Heron Mills, about Zoe? She's not sure if it really was manslaughter. What she remembers sounds a lot like an accident. But they told her Zoe didn't drink, ever, not with the medication she was on. So it must have been Anna who got her drunk that night. Anna's bad influence. Anna who behaved recklessly. It sounds a lot like the person she used to be. The person she was with Kaylee. The guard starts to walk in her direction. She puts the receiver back in its cradle without saying goodbye. Excuse me? Anna asks. The update I requested to my approved visitors list? Do you know if it went through? Can't add anyone who isn't family. The guard ushers Anna away from the phone bank. You know the rules. But Aubrey said Pathways might make an exception, since family's just my mom, and she can't... Take it up with the office, honey, She motions to the inmate at the front of the line. Next.
Chapter 5. Then, June, Heron Mills, New York. My third evening at Clovelly Cottage, I post up by the pool with my sketchbook and charcoals as soon as dinner is cleared. While the light is still good, I want to capture the way the water looks like it's vanishing clean into the landscape, inky and alchemical. I draw the pool first, then the lush yard behind, thin blades of grass fanning out to meet a robust bank of pristinely manicured trees. I brought my watercolor pencils and some oil paints, too. Maybe once I've gotten a few sketches down, I'll play around with painting the pool's silvers and navies, the emeralds and laurels of the lawn, the way the sky is a soft powder blue until the first tendrils of orange and pink sluice across it like melting sherbet. It gets dark too fast. By 8:30, the pool lights have cast the patio in a bright wash of yellow, and the world beyond the water is pure black. The back of my throat itches, and I cough into the crook of my arm, but the itch only gets worse. Summer nights mean dark bars where the air conditioning can't compete with the body heat. Long walks on never-quite-empty beaches with Star and Kaylee, the world soft and pill-blunt around us. Fumbling boozy hookups that were better as stories after than they were in the moment. Summer means never sitting still. I don't want to be back in Brooklyn, not exactly, but I don't know what to do with myself when I'm not working. Last night I had unpacking to keep me busy once the stars came out, but tonight I am fully settled into the guest cottage / pool house and at least 3 hours stretch between me and a reasonable bedtime. Inside, I place my sketchbook on the small table by the window and wonder if I should have taken a room in the main house instead. The cottage is as big as the apartment I share with my mom in Bay Ridge, and the privacy is nice, but it's almost too quiet out here. I slip out of respectable sundress number 3 and back into my cutoffs and tank top and consider heading inside to see if Amelia wants some company. But that would be weird, right? It's probably close to Paisley's bedtime. I'd be interrupting. I dig out my phone and spend some time on ModCloth, searching for dresses with pockets, then scroll through Instagram, catching up on the South Brooklyn summer, the parties I'm missing, the rowdier beach with its diverse medley of sunbathers, so different from the mostly white, all-moneyed crowd at the main beach in Heron Mills. In one photo, Mike tackles Kaylee and her hair flashes like strands of spun gold across the brassy brown of his arms. In another, Kaylee's posed on her stoop with our friend Vic from school and Wanda, another girl we go out with sometimes. I click over to Star's account to see if she's posted anything new, but there's nothing. Not that she ever posted much from Brooklyn either. We used to talk on Messenger, so I open the app, send her a quick note. Something I haven't done since the spring. It stung when she skipped town without saying goodbye. She'd told Kaylee her plans, and Mike, but I guess I didn't rank. Now she's not responding to my messages either. I tell myself it's not personal, that she got the fresh start I'm looking for now. We had fun, but I know her life in Brooklyn wasn't great. 22, no college, shitty job waiting tables at an all-night diner in Brighton Beach, estranged from her ultra-conservative family in Arizona, a string of boyfriends who didn't stick around long. She always loved Disney. I tell myself it's not about me. By 9, cabin fever has officially set in. My fingers dance across the screen, itching to open my messages, text Kaylee. My phone has been trenchantly quiet all day. Either Kaylee has given up on me or she's serving up a bitter taste of my own medicine. Knowing my best friend, it's surely the latter. I press my phone face down into my comforter and shrug on a hoodie. Then I spritz some bug spray on my legs, grab one of the several mini flashlights from the glass bowl on the kitchen counter, and head out into the night. My starlit tour of the Clovelly Cottage grounds is surprisingly brief. Maybe Tom was right. 2.2 acres isn't quite as massive as it initially seemed. I hug the tree line, crossing behind the pool, then past the detached garage and gurgling fountain on my way toward the tennis court. But when I'm there, I can't figure out how to turn on the lights, and the rackets appear to be locked in the storage shed anyway. I abandon my plan of privately smacking balls in the general direction of the net and trudge down the pebbled drive toward the road instead. The LED beam casts a thin white veil over the bushes as I pass. Azaleas, according to Emilia, their pink flowers fluttering in the breeze with a ghostly glimmer that makes me shiver, despite the still warm air. I zip my hoodie all the way to my throat. Out on Linden Lane, I think about turning right, stealing a glimpse of the houses on the longer stretch of street Tom and I didn't cover on our way in, but my feet are drawn instead toward Windermere, sneakers pulling me next door, toward its neglected grounds. When I get to the wrought iron entrance gate, all vine-covered rails and scrolls and flourishes, the first thing I notice is how much closer the house is to the road than Clovelly Cottage or the other newer houses in Heron Mills. Here, standing in the slice of driveway that isn't entirely obscured by the unfettered growth of the privacy hedge, I have a clear view of Windermere through the gaps in the gate. The porch light is on, bathing the unused swing and blue-painted rocking chairs in soft, pale light. I switch my flashlight off and tuck it in my pocket, lean into the shadows surrounding the pillar on which the gate hinges. Tom said that Windermere was built in 1894, which must make it one of the older original homes in the area. I try to imagine this swath of the Hamptons before Seacrest, or Magnolia House, or Clovelly Cottage. The landscape must have seemed unlimited, nothing but farmland and sky. There would have been no need for hedges or tall banks of trees to keep the estate's secrets veiled from nosy neighbors. And Linden Lane was probably barely traveled, the silence even deeper than it is tonight. Hello? I rocket back from the pillar, skin buzzing with something that feels like electricity or fear. Hello? The word passes through my lips, more demand than question, as if I'm not the one skulking in shadow, gawking at someone else's house after dark. On the other side of the gate, a figure steps into the driveway from somewhere on the front lawn, a part of the property blocked from my view. He's slim and not too tall, maybe 5'10". His hands are shoved in jeans pockets, and a silver watch band glints on one wrist. "Are you lost?" he asks. I squint into the glow of the porch light, trying to get a good look at his face, but I can see only that his skin is a soft shade of brown, and he's my age, maybe a bit older. My heartbeat slows to a slightly elevated thud. This must be Caden Talbot, the Yaley. "I'm Anna," I say. "The nanny at Clovelly Cottage?" "Oh, right." He leans leisurely against the pillar, his body pressed against the stone in a mirror image of my stance a moment ago. Emilia mentioned she'd hired someone new. "I'm sorry I was staring." My words slip out on a hot rush of breath. "I'm not a creeper. Well, not usually." As my eyes strain to compose something photorealistic from his backlit silhouette, an itchy sensation crawls down my spine. This boy is a stranger, but for a slippery moment I can see our lives intertwining. Our darkest secrets and deepest fears laid bare in the still night air. He grins, and just as suddenly the itchy feeling is gone, and along with it my pseudo-psychic inklings. I'm clearly lonely, and maybe a little bored. "It's okay," he says. "Windermere is something to behold. I'm Caden, by the way." He sticks his hand through a scroll in the gate, and I take it in mine, forcing myself to behave like the friendly stranger I am. It's warm and smooth, and he smells just slightly of sage and vanilla. Everything about him seems well cared for, in sharp contrast to the house in the background. "I just got in on Monday," I tell him. "I'm still getting to know the area." "After dark?" I shrug. I can feel the darkness wrapped around my skin like a cloak. "There's not a lot to do at night. I was restless." "Yeah, me too." He gestures toward the lawn to my left, beyond my line of sight. "We used to have a koi pond. Now it's mostly frogs and weeds. I was thinking about how I might clean it up." "After dark?" I throw the question back at him. He laughs, a warm, easy sound that makes my skin flush beneath my hoodie. "I do my best thinking at night. Besides, I'm stuck here right now."
"At home?"
"Yeah. My mom gets kind of freaked out when I leave Windermere at night." I can feel my eyebrows arch up my forehead, but Caden must not be able to see the face I'm making in the dark. A college boy with a curfew? I've been basically leashless in the city for as long as I can remember. I can't fathom staying home at night to please my mother, even if home was on multiple acres.
"How old are you?"
The words are out of my mouth before I can bite them back. He laughs again, but it's cooler this time. 19. My mom hasn't been doing great. That's why I'm home this summer.
"Oh, sorry. Now I feel like a jerk. You're at Yale?"
"Just finished my second year. Amelia tell you about me?"
"Tom gave me the Linden Lane tour when we were driving in."
He grunts softly, and I strain to get a better look at his face, but he's still backlit in the porch light. "You in school?" he asks.
"Just graduated. I start at SUNY New Paltz in the fall."
He says something about liking the New Paltz area, how he has a friend studying theater there. He recommends a place to go hiking, and I make a mental note for September. I wonder for a moment if he's going to open the gate, invite me inside. Maybe this is the start of something, or the sequel to a memory idling deep beneath the surface. But then a light blinks on the third floor of the house, and a filmy shadow darkens the window. Caden turns to follow my gaze up, toward Windermere.
"I should go in," he says, voice suddenly brisk.
I don't want this conversation to be over. I haven't gotten a chance to ask about his mom, what's wrong with her, why he can't leave. But I can see his body closing up, shoulders hunching inward, and I know it's not the right time.
"It was nice meeting you."
He's already backing away from the gate. He gives me a small wave before he turns. "See you around, Anna." Back in the guest cottage, I dig out my watercolor pencils from my bag. Sketchbook spread out on the bed, I draw a slender boy with light brown skin and a silver wristwatch. His arm and side are propped gracefully against a stone pillar crawling with vines, and one foot is crossed over the other where the pillar meets the drive. In my drawing, he's turning to look at a brightly lit window in the house behind him, and his face is lost in shadow.
Chapter 6. Then, June, Heron Mills, New York. Paisley wants ice cream. I raise my eyes from my bowl of granola and yogurt to peer at Amelia across the breakfast table, ready for her to tell her daughter she'll have to wait until after dinner.
but Amelia just nods and digs in her wallet for cash before slipping into her office and closing the door. While I load our dishes into the sink, Paisley chatters excitedly about Jenkins Creamery, the much-lauded shop on Main Street that has withstood the luxury brand takeover for two generations. In the few days I've been in town, I've already had it recommended to me 3 times. I insist we wait until 11, when the shop opens, then we set off on foot, leaving Amelia to her client work and the mid-morning sunshine that spills through the east-facing windows at the front of Clovelly Cottage like yards and yards of buttery gauze. When we reach the end of the drive, Paisley tugs my hand, pulling me right, away from the shortest route to town.
"This way," she insists. "It's prettier."
I let myself be dragged, momentarily mourning the fact that I won't get to steal another glimpse of Windermere, possibly see Caden in daylight. Last night, he trailed me across a series of dreams I otherwise can't remember, the features on his face shifting and rearranging into something out of Picasso's Cubist period. I can vividly see the outline of his body, the way he turned to meet his mother's gaze in the upstairs window, but his face is a mystery to me, an endless jumble of possibilities that won't let my artist's brain rest until I see him again. I tell myself that's all it is, the painter in me in need of artistic resolution. Caden and Windermere quickly fade into birdsong and Paisley's bright chatter as we walk the other way down Linden Lane, Paisley giving me her own version of a tour, which centers around which families have kids, how old they are, and who's here and who's renting out their house for the summer while they flit around Europe or Japan. Pretty nice set of options. I press my lips between my teeth.
"Do you have friends on your street in Brooklyn?" Paisley asks.
"Sure, although we've moved a few times. When I was your age, I had 2 really good friends on our block, Krista and Jayla. Our parents called us AAA. Paisley wrinkles her nose at me, fine lines creasing her soft skin. "Because our names all ended in A? Krista? Jayla? Anna?"
"It would be better if your names all started with A," Paisley declares, then pulls me around the corner, off Linden Lane and onto a connecting street that will take us into town.
Paisley clearly knows where she's going, but I checked the route on my phone before we started, just in case. The streets here form a wide, irregular grid, spaced far apart to accommodate the properties in between, and even on this slightly longer route, we'll make it to Jenkins by 11:15. They'd better have coffee ice cream. When we turn onto Main, I'm surprised by how busy the street seems for a Thursday morning. Shop doors open and close, and sidewalk cafe tables are filled as we pass, the empty peace of the residential streets replaced by a low-key bustle.
"Doesn't anyone work around here?"
I mutter, instantly regretting the twinge of contempt in my voice. Paisley responds with complete solemnity.
"Not the summer people. They're here on vacation. Mommy and Daddy are working."
"Of course they are," I say, steering Paisley around an overexcited Jack Russell straining on his leash. "That's why you've got me." Inside Jenkins, we stand before a giant wall-mounted menu that looks like a chalkboard, but its descriptions are so vivid and smudge-free, I wonder if it's actually paint. The shop is empty, aside from Paisley and me. Behind the counter, a man in a white smock is crouched down, fiddling with something behind the case of hard ice cream. The menu boasts 12 flavors, all homemade, and an array of toppings. There's also a soft ice cream machine with levers for chocolate, vanilla, and twists, and a selection of 2 sorbets. In the very center of the menu, inside a box with jagged edges like a bright blue starburst, is the shop's featured flavor, chocolate caramel popcorn.
"I want 2 scoops of peanut butter cup," Paisley says, but her words wash over me.
I'm still fixed on the menu board, that bright blue box advertising something I'd never usually order. But I can taste the flavor at the back of my mouth, coating my tongue like a memory. Chocolate caramel popcorn. I stare until my eyes lose focus, until the words squiggle and pulse against the blackness like a lighthouse in a storm. Suddenly, I'm a little lightheaded, and I lean my hip against the glass to keep my balance.
"Always get a waffle cone," Paisley advises, and I force myself to tear my eyes away from the menu, focus on her.
Mr. Jenkins fills the bottom with hard chocolate so the ice cream doesn't leak.
"Shop secret,"
says the man behind the counter, his deep, earthy voice snapping me back to reality. He straightens up and leans slightly forward over the glass to give Paisley a grin.
"But your friend will find out soon enough."
He's in his 50s, I'd guess, ruddy cheeks studded with black points of stubble. His crisp white smock reads Lou Jenkins in curvy embroidery. I raise my eyes to meet his, which are hazel and creased with kind lines. In that moment, his expression changes, geniality sliding away into something between awe and dread.
"Zoe?"
he splutters. Before I can figure out how to respond, Paisley cuts in, her voice like a chime.
"This is Anna Ciccone. She's from Bay Ridge in Brooklyn, New York. Anna is my au pair for the summer."
Lou Jenkins takes a small step back, taking me in. He runs his hand across his face, in a gesture that makes my mind skip back to the other day on the beach. Kyle, the lifeguard, peering under the umbrella, his hand tracing the same bewildered route across his eyelids and cheeks.
"Christ, I'm sorry. I thought you were someone else."
"Who's Zoe?" Nerves bunch in a tight knot in my stomach. I gather my hair back self-consciously, slip an elastic from my wrist, and twist it up into a messy knot on top of my head.
"Zoe Spanos disappeared last January," Paisley supplies. "No one knows what happened to her."
"That's horrible. From Heron Mills?"
"She grew up here,"
Lou explains. His face has not yet regained its formerly jovial glow, but at least he's stopped looking at me like I'm a ghost.
"She was in college, home on winter break. She went out on New Year's Eve, and her family hasn't heard from her since."
"And I look like her?" I ask, the need to name the elephant in the room burning hot in my throat. Paisley nods eagerly, like this is a game we're all playing and not some highly cryptic coincidence.
"I think it's mostly your hair and your face."
I laugh, the tension bubbling up, then bursting like the sharp crack of gum against my lips.
"Just my hair and face?"
Lou tilts his chin to the side.
"With your hair up, there's less of a resemblance. And she has more of an olive complexion. But you two could be sisters."
He smiles.
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable. Everyone in Heron Mills has been a little on edge since Zoe disappeared."
I do the mental math back to New Year's Eve. That was nearly 6 months ago. I don't know a whole lot about missing girls, but I'm pretty sure the odds she'll show up alive after this much time must be pretty slim.
"Can I get you ladies some ice cream?"
Lou asks, a burst of energy filling his voice like he's clutching some invisible steering wheel, directing us onto a new course.
"Or maybe a coffee or tea?"
Paisley gives him her order, and while the rational part of my brain says to ask for black coffee, which is probably the only thing I can stomach after that exchange, I hear myself ordering a scoop of the chocolate caramel popcorn.
"Waffle cone?"
Lou asks.
"Just a cup,"
I reply, then assure Paisley I'll order a cone next time, if she promises future trips to Jenkins can be scheduled for after lunch. Outside, the street is drenched in crisp white sunlight, and the strange encounter in the shop rolls off my shoulders like the last wisps of stale morning fog off the East River. Paisley and I post up on a wooden bench about a block down from Jenkins to eat and people watch. The ice cream tastes like chocolate Easter eggs, and the popcorn from those big tins they sell at Target around the holidays. It tastes like childhood. It tastes amazing. Want to try? I offer. That's okay, Paisley says. I've had it before. It's their most popular flavor. Dad says that Mr. Jenkins says that his dad invented it. The original Mr. Jenkins. I prefer peanut butter. Hey, Paisley. We look up to find two girls around my age stopped on the sidewalk in front of our bench. One is wearing a red and white checkered sundress that looks vintage and a pair of Mary Jane flats the color of cherry pie filling. Her glossy brown hair is bone straight and pulled back in a neat ponytail, and her skin is a soft fawn brown. The other girl is dressed like me, denim shorts and a tank top. She's only 5'3" or 5'4", but she's all muscle, a swimmer, or maybe a gymnast. Her hair is cropped into a feathery pixie cut that emphasizes the surprising plumpness of her cheekbones and cool olive of her skin. A pair of large gold hoop earrings, the metal helixed into a delicate twist at the base of each hoop, dangle from her ears. Hey, Aster! Paisley holds out her cone for me to take and jumps up to give the shorter girl a hug. I can feel two sets of eyes trained on me, their faces narrowing into the same apprehensive scrutiny I saw play across Lou's face a few minutes ago. I'm Anna, I supply quickly, eager to nip those looks in the bud. I shove up to my feet. Paisley's nanny. Martina Green. The girl in the vintage dress sticks out her hand, then drops it when she realizes mine are both filled with ice cream. Her friend rolls her eyes. She's Martina Jenkins. Green is like a stage name or something. Martina flashes Aster a flinty glare. It's my professional name, she says, as if that clarifies anything. She can't be any older than I am. What kind of profession could possibly require a name change? The ice cream profession? Jenkins must be her family's shop. I wonder fleetingly if she's a print model. She doesn't look quite tall enough, but she's obviously into fashion, and she has that slightly edgy Urban Outfitters look. I must be making a face because Martina sighs, as if resigning herself to an explanation that makes her tired. I'm going to be a journalist, and my mother doesn't like the idea of attaching the family name to my investigative work. She's old school like that. Like TV news and stuff? I ask. For now, I'm editor-in-chief of my school paper, and I run a podcast series. Well, ran. She offers Aster a weak smile, then drops her eyes to the sidewalk. For a moment, everyone is quiet. And I wonder how many uncomfortable exchanges one morning can possibly hold. The podcast is about Zoe, Paisley explains in a reverent voice, her chin tilted up toward me. Aster and Zoe are sisters, and Martina's going to find out what happened to her. Aster and Zoe, A to Z. I glance back at the shorter girl, noting how little she resembles me. Or vice versa. Which means she must not look much like Zoe either. But of course, not all siblings look alike. I remember Lou saying something about Zoe having an olive complexion, though, and as the sun glints off Aster's gold hoops and olive shoulders, it strikes me that they're probably Greek. Spanos. I did my best, Martina says. I'm so sorry, Aster. Aster wraps one toned arm around Martina's shoulders and gives her friend a jostling squeeze. It's the police who dropped the ball, not you, she says, voice kind. My gaze comes to rest on the raw red lines of sadness that have settled along the rims of her eyes. She looks like she's been living 10 seconds away from tears for months. Martina leans down to kiss the top of her friend's head, and Aster's lips soften into a smile.
"Okay, no more Zoe talk before lunch," she says, straightening up.
"Do we still have time for sushi before your shift?" Her eyes flicker toward the ice cream shop. Martina digs her phone out of her pocket. Of course, her dress has pockets, and turns on the screen. "Plenty. Dad can hold down the fort for another hour." The girls wave and say it was nice to meet me, and I hand Paisley back her melting cone. She takes a big lick.
"Zoe used to babysit me when she was in high school," she says. "Aster's 3 years younger. She was my babysitter after Zoe went to college."
"I thought you had Lindsay," I say. "Wasn't that your last au pair?"
"Lindsay was only in the summers," Paisley says. "Like you. I'd have Zoe and Aster on the weekends, or if Mom and Dad went out on a date night. Zoe was super nice, but I think Aster was my favorite babysitter."
"Why's that?" Paisley works at her cone, and we start ambling slowly down Main Street.
"Because she's brave. This one time, before school let out last June, I told her about this boy Marcus who was teasing me. My teacher wasn't doing anything to stop it, so Aster came up with this whole plan to get back at him. Marcus was having a pool party for his birthday, so the night before, we snuck around to the back of his house and dumped buckets of water mixed with yellow food coloring into his pool. It looked like it was full of pee." Paisley giggles.
"That doesn't sound very mature, but it definitely sounds fun." Paisley grins, but then her smile drops.
"Aster's had to be really brave this year, and her parents too. That's what my mom says, because Zoe's probably not coming back." I toss the remains of my melted ice cream in a trash bin, the nostalgia factor fading into sugary soup. I reach out for Paisley's hand, and she slips it into mine.
"Why didn't you tell me I look like the missing girl?"
Paisley shrugs and takes another lick. "Everybody loves Zoe. I don't see why it's a big deal."
I guess it isn't, but I resolve to order a few more sun hats along with my pocket dresses as soon as I get paid. I'm not sure I'm up for an entire summer of weird looks and mistaken identities.
"Did you listen to her podcast?" I ask.
"Mom won't let me. She says it's too adult." Her voice forms air quotes around the words.
"Oh, that sucks."
Paisley chomps down on her waffle cone, channeling the unfairness of childhood into the bite.
"But she might be right," I shrug. "Sounds like scary stuff."
"Yeah." For a minute, she stares down at our feet, sandals keeping pace on the sidewalk together.
"Do you think she'll come back, Anna?"
A thin blade of worry glides up my ribcage and settles between my lungs. Is there a right answer to that question? What would Amelia say?
"I don't know." My voice is quiet. "I hope so."
In the pool house that night, I Google Zoe Spanos. The results fill my phone screen, dozens of news articles from last winter and spring about the 19-year-old girl who disappeared from Heron Mills without a trace. I click on the first one, and the photos of Zoe make my breath catch. She does, as promised, look a hell of a lot like me. Same messy cascade of black hair, same high-set cheekbones and big, toothy smile. But her skin is creamy olive where mine is pasty white. Her eyes yellow-flecked brown where mine are a sharp blue-green. She has what looks like a splotchy brown birthmark near the center of her collarbone, where my skin is bare. Resting against it, in most of the photos, is a delicate gold chain with the initials ZS. Me, but not me. The similarities are striking. They prick at the corners of my eyelids, making me squint and then open wide until I see myself, then don't again. I remember in 9th grade, this new kid Brian told me I reminded him of his friend from home. He held out his phone across the cafeteria table, showed me a picture of a stranger that was like looking into a funhouse mirror. It's that feeling all over again. I quickly scan through the other search results, looking for a podcast. I try again with Martina Green Podcast in the search bar, and I'm directed to 4 episodes of Missing Zoe on SoundCloud. There's a thumbnail picture of Martina wearing a pair of black cat-eye glasses and burgundy lipstick, her hair styled in the same ponytail I saw today. The podcast description promises in-depth investigative reporting with a single goal: to uncover what really happened to Zoe last New Year's Eve. A chilly finger of curiosity tinged with fear zips down my spine, and I slip my earbuds in.
Missing Zoe, Episode 1. She's not a little runaway.
It's not illegal to disappear.
If Zoe was there, I would have known. Zoe never showed up that night.
911, what's your emergency?
My name is George Spanos, and my daughter Zoe is missing.
Today is Tuesday, February 11th, and Zoe Spanos has been missing for 6 weeks to the day. Last Friday, the Heron Mills Village PD declared Zoe a runaway, and that's why I'm here, talking to you. Because if you know Zoe, you know she didn't run away. Zoe Spanos is missing. And we're missing Zoe. Hi, I'm Martina Green, and you're listening to the first episode of Missing Zoe, a multi-part podcast series about the disappearance of Zoe Spanos, a 19-year-old resident of Heron Mills, New York, on the night of December 31st, or morning of January 1st this year. You can probably tell from my voice that I'm not your typical true crime podcast host. I'm a junior at Jefferson High School in Heron Mills. That's on the east end of Long Island, one of those quaint beach towns you might visit one summer for the ocean, the lobster rolls, the relaxed pace of village life. For many, Heron Mills is a destination, an escape. But for others, like Zoe and me, it's home. Let's begin by taking a quick stroll through Heron Mills. Consider this your welcome tour.
You might notice there's been a bit of a commercial boom around here lately.
There's no greater expert on the textured history of Zoe's hometown than village historian Alfred Harvey. We spoke in his office at the Heron Mills Village Historical Society.
But it retains rich elements of its agrarian past in the surrounding farmland and the farm-to-table restaurants that have cropped up. And, of course, the windmills.
And there's a long-standing artistic history as well?
Of course. The village was initially settled in the 1600s and incorporated in 1873. Artists and writers began to flock to the Hamptons, including Heron Mills, in the late 19th century. They came for the quiet, the rural beauty, the light. The culture of creation is part of the fabric of the landscape out here. Nowadays, when people hear the Hamptons, they hear wealth, celebrity, privilege. But that's only part of the story. On the Bayside, in Sag Harbor, there's been a thriving African-American community since World War II. The Shinnecock Reservation in Southampton is home to between 600 and 700 tribal members. There's much more to the Hamptons than exclusivity and wealth.
When you're a resident of Heron Mills, you know everyone. I've known Zoe since I was a baby. Her sister Aster is my best friend. I'm telling you this in the interest of full disclosure.
I'm not an unbiased reporter, an outsider looking in. I'm not someone with a 20-year career in journalism behind me, although I hope I will be someday. But I don't think that's what we need to find Zoe. I think we need an insider. Someone who knows this community, knows the people, isn't afraid to ask the tough questions the police don't seem interested in exploring.
It's not illegal to disappear.
I spoke to Assistant Detective Philip Massey, one of the officers on the Zoe Spanos case, over the phone.
I can't comment specifically on the Spanos case, but in general, you're an adult. It's perfectly legal to leave your life behind, start a new one. Might be hurtful or unkind, but there's no law you have to tell anyone where you're going.
Why can't you discuss Zoe specifically? Didn't your office close the investigation last week?
As our office stated publicly last Friday, there is strong evidence to suggest Miss Spanos willingly left Heron Mills on the night of December 31st last year. That's all I can say. It's still an open investigation.
The investigation may still technically remain open, but it's clear that local police have wound down their search. Yes, Zoe is 19. Yes, that means she's an adult in the eyes of law enforcement, allowed to step willingly away from her sophomore year at Brown, from her holiday at home with her family and friends, and start over somewhere new. No note, no explanation, no news 6 weeks later. But I don't buy it, and that's why I'm here. I'm angry, and that's why I'm here. So, let's go back to late December of last year. For those of you who have been following Zoe's case, none of this will come as new information. Everything I'm about to recap was widely reported on the news during the days and weeks that followed Zoe's disappearance. But it's important to start with the facts we can agree upon, the things that are known, and to examine critically the way in which law enforcement approached the case once Zoe was reported missing. Before she disappeared, Zoe had been home from Brown for about 2 weeks, spending time with her family. Several Heron Mills residents saw Zoe around town.
She spent a few afternoons at the library. Nothing unusual about that. Zoe always was very serious about her studies.
That was Judith Hodgson, reference librarian at the Heron Mills Public Library. I personally saw Zoe twice, once at the grocery store where she was helping her mom with the shopping, and again on the day after Christmas, when Astra and I spent the afternoon together at the Spanos house. Zoe was baking cookies in the kitchen. We talked for a few minutes about the marine bio internship she'd done in California over the summer and the advanced research course she'd be taking in the spring.
I was looking forward to working with Miss Spanos this spring. She made quite a case to get into my class. I have a firm policy about restricting admission to upperclassmen, but Miss Spanos had completed the prerequisites early, and she showed a great deal of promise.
Professor David Brecker spoke with me on the phone from his office at Brown. Why would Zoe campaign to get into that course if she wasn't planning to return to school? There was nothing in Zoe's behavior that pointed to a girl making plans to sever ties, to vanish into the night. Fast forward to New Year's Eve, a Tuesday. Zoe left the house around 9 o'clock. She told her parents that she was meeting friends at a nearby house party thrown by Jacob Traynor, a Jefferson alum from Zoe's class. Multiple sources, including Zoe's friend Lydia Summer, confirmed she never made it to that party.
I texted her a few times that night. No response, which wasn't like Zoe at all.
Is it possible that she went to Jacob's with someone else? That you might have missed her?
No way. If Zoe was there, I would have known. Someone would have seen her. It was almost all Jefferson alum at that party. We all knew each other. Zoe never showed up that night.
The next morning, Mr. and Mrs. Spanos woke to the realization that Zoe had not returned home. If you read the comments on the news articles that ran in the following days, or dive into the Reddit thread about Zoe's case, you'll see that many people were immediately critical of their parenting. But let's remember, Zoe is 19 and a sophomore in college. Her parents were used to her living away from home, where she'd been an A student at an Ivy League college. And as the police have been so quick to emphasize, Zoe is an adult. Her parents knew where she was going, to a party within walking distance from their home. She hadn't had a curfew since high school. Let's stop blaming the Spanos family. They didn't do anything wrong. In fact, they did exactly what they should have done. The morning of Wednesday, January 1st, when Zoe wasn't responding to phone calls or texts, Mr. Spanos called 911.
911, what's your emergency?
It was New Year's Day,
and local police had been dealing with their share of calls throughout the night and into the morning. Two separate car accidents on Grove and Ocean Avenue, noise complaints, vandalism, a stolen boat, we're going to get back to that in a minute, littering, trespassing, you name it. If you're going to go missing, New Year's Eve is probably just about the worst time to do it. Or the best time to disappear, if you believe the police.
My name is George Spanos, and my daughter Zoe is missing. We're at 45 Crescent Circle, Heron Mills, New York. She didn't come home last night.
911 dispatch transferred Mr. Spanos to the local police. We don't have access to that recording, but according to TV interviews that ran in the following week, they told Mr. Spanos to check local hospitals and call around to Zoe's friends and their parents. They told him that Zoe had probably spent the night at a friend's house, and perhaps her phone battery had died. They told him to do his due diligence, but to try not to worry. Zoe wasn't a minor. She was responsible and bright. What the police suggested was a perfectly plausible scenario. The most likely scenario. It made sense. But it was wrong. Spanos's made those calls. Zoe had not been admitted to any hospital on Long Island. No one had seen her. She had not been to Jacob Traynor's party. She hadn't called anyone to say she wasn't going to make it. She hadn't responded when three separate friends, including Lydia Summer, checked in via phone or text between 11:35 p.m. and 1:17 a.m. Zoe Spanos walked out of her house in Heron Mills around 9 o'clock on New Year's Eve and vanished into thin air. On the morning of Thursday, January 2nd, when Zoe had still not come home or contacted anyone to say she was okay, the police finally started searching. A pair of officers went door to door in the neighborhood. Zoe was declared a missing person, her photo and description shared with local news. The police worked with the Spanos family to organize a search party for the morning of January 4th, to comb the woods behind the Spanos property. But by the 4th, they had uncovered something else. Remember that missing boat I mentioned earlier? On the morning of January 1st, Mrs. Catherine Hunt of Heron Mills reported her small motorboat missing from its post at the White Sand Marina, one of two local marinas where residents can purchase docking permits.
I assumed it was kids partying in the area. It was New Year's, after all. But then on Thursday afternoon, I heard on the news that there might be a connection between my boat and the missing girl. It was shocking.
When the boat had not turned up 2 days later, and an investigation into Zoe's cell phone records determined that the last GPS activity on her phone could place her within a 100-foot radius of the marina at 2:12 on the morning of January 1st, the police put two and two together. But here's where I think they got their math mixed up. The search went ahead as planned on the morning of the 4th, but with a fraction of the expected turnout. I was there. Zoe's family was there. There were maybe 30 of us total, friends of Zoe's home from college, neighbors, family friends. Searchers did not find anything in the woods. At the same time, the Heron Mills PD arranged for the ocean floor to be dragged in and around the White Sand Marina. Dozens of onlookers, who should have been searching, showed up there instead.
It seemed at the time like the divers might find something that day. The marina isn't large. I'm sure they did a thorough job, but if she made it out of the marina onto the open ocean...
The initial working theory was that Zoe had arrived to the marina early Wednesday morning, released Mrs. Hunt's boat from its post, or more likely found it already liberated by New Year's revelers who had taken their party elsewhere, and that she tried to take the boat out and drowned. The Spanos family was horrified, but police overturned that theory lightning fast with a new one. Zoe didn't drown. She took the boat, and she literally sailed away into the night.
We've now concluded an initial investigation into Ms. Spanos' financial records and can report that the 212 data activity on her Verizon-registered cell phone was a PayPal transaction. The purchase from Ms. Spanos' account was for a one-way bus ticket from Asbury Park to Philadelphia for the evening of January 1st. Ms. Spanos' phone was turned off after the transaction went through and no further activity has been registered.
We're hearing a clip of A.D. Massey from Channel 4 News, which aired on the night of January 7th. That's right, listeners. The police actually think Zoe Spanos attempted to motorboat across the Atlantic to the Jersey Shore to board a bus to Philadelphia, and that she succeeded. Maybe it's possible for an experienced boater, which Zoe was not. The police have latched onto the fact that Zoe was majoring in marine biology like it's some kind of proof she was an expert in all things nautical. Newsflash, college-level research knowledge of the giant squid does not equal experience with boating or aquatic navigation. Maybe it would have been a plausible escape route for a desperate person. But here's the thing. While the purchase is indisputable, the fine folks at Greyhound Lines cannot confirm that Zoe actually got on that bus. This clip is also from Channel 4, from the evening of January 9th.
We have no record that the ticket purchased by Zoe Spanos was scanned. Our scanner was working and in use, and we've turned our records over to the police. It is highly unlikely that Zoe Spanos boarded the 317 line on the night of January 1st.
If Zoe's phone was turned off following that PayPal transaction, how did she navigate Mrs. Hunt's motorboat to New Jersey? The police theory would require a good deal of advanced planning on Zoe's part. It would also require a good deal of stupidity and desperation, neither of which describe Zoe at all. So, what do we know about Zoe? Fact 1. Zoe had access to her parents' car. If she wanted to get to Asbury Park, or Philadelphia for that matter, she could have driven herself there. Fact 2. Zoe also had access to the LIRR. If she was concerned about being charged with Grand Theft Auto, she could have easily hopped on a train. Fact 3. If Zoe was really trying to run away, leave no trace, why would she create an obvious digital trail with the PayPal transaction? She had access to plenty of cash, yet did not withdraw any from her bank account before she disappeared. Additionally, none of Zoe's accounts have been accessed since. Fact 4. Zoe had no reason to run away from her life. This has been the sticking point for police, the motive they can't produce. But they don't need to produce a motive, because Zoe's supposed choice to run away isn't a crime. Over the course of the past 6 weeks, police have proposed an unlikely string of theories. That Zoe didn't make it all the way to Asbury Park, drowned somewhere out in the Atlantic. Which would actually seem the most logical scenario if you believe that Zoe would have attempted to make the boat trip in the first place, which I firmly do not. That Zoe made it to Asbury Park, but then rerouted. That she met up with friends with a car. That she purchased the bus ticket to deliberately lead us off track. What friends in New Jersey? And where is the boat? As of last Friday, search efforts in Asbury Park, Philadelphia, and along Zoe's supposed oceanic route have officially wound down. From what we can tell in Heron Mills, they unofficially wound down a lot sooner than that. We've been told there's no way to clearly trace her path, that without communication from Zoe, who clearly does not want to be found, it's like searching for a needle in a haystack. So, I'm here to ask the questions the police won't, because Zoe Spanos had no reason to run away, and certainly not in the way the police think she did. I'm here to propose that there's no connection between Zoe and that missing boat. Yes, she, or her phone, was in the vicinity of the marina that night. She, or someone who had access to her phone, purchased that bus ticket. But that's where the connection between Zoe and the boat ends. Something happened to Zoe Spanos on New Year's Eve, and someone knows what it was. Someone knows where Zoe is. Zoe, I hope you're alive. I hope you're still out there. There are a lot of people at home who are missing you. And no matter what the police think, I, Martina Green, am going to try my hardest to uncover the truth and bring you home.
Chapter 7. Now, September, Heron Mills, New York. Martina waits patiently to be connected to Anna Ciccone at the Pathways Juvenile Center. Her phone is on speaker on the kitchen table, ready to record.